This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And here's a question for you. Will U.S. oil production exceed 13.4 million barrels per day for April 2025? Well, the yes forecast, the contract recently traded at 39%, and the no was at 59%. With Interactive Brokers forecast contracts, you can trade on future events like climate change or the economy or even politics. You choose yes or no, and if you're right, you get paid. It's that simple. Explore trending data on U.S. oil production, spot the trends, and make your prediction for April 2025. Trade forecast contracts at Interactive Brokers and earn a dollar for every correct prediction. Plus, you'll earn 3.83% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon, and you'll get $3 when you start trading forecast contracts. Now, be aware that forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. Go to ibkr.com/forecast and start predicting today. The last day trading for this contract is June 29th.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The tariff saga continues. We got this taco trade and the courts now. The big, beautiful bill, it's in jeopardy. And May was a jolly good month for stocks. Equities ripped. Our guest today, back from an eight-year hiatus on the show, Barry Ritholtz, co-founder of Ritholtz Wealth Management. All this and much more on episode number 923 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome to the summer. Yeah, June's here. And we're buckling in. I mean, who knows what's going to happen next, right? I mean, if it wasn't so serious, it'd kind of be funny, all this. Har, har, hearty, har. I mean, what is going on right now with the tariff on, tariff off, the decisions, the courts, the fact that now there's an attack going on with the taco trade. If you hadn't heard that, that's the Trump taco, T-A-C-O, Trump. Always chickens out. That's the word on Wall Street that's going on right now, and why you may be seeing that into some of the things that are going on, that markets are very resilient and, in fact, did a big turnaround because they're realizing that a lot of things, or at least from the perspective of Wall Street, that maybe some of the things aren't actually going to happen the way they're being said they're going to happen. In fact, when push comes to shove in this negotiation process, the art of the deal maybe isn't, in fact, so artsy at all, and maybe we are going to flinch, blink first. But nonetheless, a big hello from downtown Fort Lauderdale. Yeah, we're actually in a business office building here. That's not just sand and ocean. Nope, even though it seems like it. In fact, I was in the ocean last weekend. I was down in the Keys, and I got hit with some of the, I think they're called sea lice or something like that, where there's the baby jellyfish are swimming around and they attach to you and then they get mad that they're there and then they sting you. They give you these welts for about a week and a half, 2 weeks, and they itch like crazy. And that's what's going on right now. Anyway, I'm Andrew Horowitz. I'm behind the mic again. Microphone, here we are. We have another great guest coming up. Before we get to that, though, I think we need to talk about some of the things that are going on right now. And you heard it right. You heard it. The courts smacked down the tariffs. The presidential tariffs that were put on by executive order were basically said to be illegal. And that I don't think that was too surprising. I think that the courts are allowing things to go ahead to see where they go. And now, because of the processing time of many of these court cases, it's starting to show up that a lot of things are actually not legal, unconstitutional. There's something not right with all this. And last week, we actually did a deep dive here in the office looking at whether or not there is a potential for the illegality of the tariffs. And I wanted to see exactly how this is going to go about. And I really was looking at this because I was kind of surprised at the ability for the president to raise and lower and change and by whim say that Apple's going to have a 25% tariff on their phones coming into the United States if, in fact, they're not built here in the United States, right? And any parts or whatever. And then he went on to say that not only that, that any smartphone that comes into the United States that's not built in the United States will, in fact, be tariffed. And I started thinking about this is getting a little out of hand. And I don't think there's any rhyme or reason, any vision, any plan, any process going on here. And that is something that really was troubling me. And I wanted to look into what is really allowed to happen. And what we found was that the way that these tariffs were being issued, a lot of these under some kind of an emergency act plan or an emergency order, the backup of and rationale of why these were going in was kind of thin. And I know that tariffs can be put on by a president. That's not a question, right? They don't, there's no problem with that, but they don't seem to be allowed to be done in the way that they were being used. The reciprocal tariffs, the retaliatory tariffs, those ones were the biggest issue at hand. Those are the ones that really were put on. And the way they were put on, I think what they did is they stepped on their own toes by utilizing those phrases and that process and trying to get that on. So there will be a court battle now, and that's going to take some time. And the reason why I'm talking about this, because I think there's something behind the scenes that some people are missing here. Because we're not exactly sure how long this is going to take, how long this is going to play out, whether or not, in fact, it will come back that it's legal. It may go up to the Supreme Court on this. And how this comes out is the big question. And what we have also found recently is that some of the court decisions have gone against the presidential usage of these very broad and sweeping powers that are going, as they say, you know, they don't want to be unchecked. They're there to protect the Constitution and the legality of all this. And there's a lot of things that are starting to come out here, and I think that this is now going to be thrown into that, and that's why I'm focusing on this. I'm not focusing on the politics and the, you know, whether it's Republican or Democrat, or I'm focusing on, as we always do here, the financial aspects of how this is going to play out. Now, I'm not saying that executive orders can't be used, but in some areas, there are processes for some things that need to be respected. And when we look at the various laws and the ways that presidential use them, well, for example, I made a list of these because I went through and tried to find out, and I went to the Congressional Research Service, and they've identified six different laws that govern presidential tariff powers. Three of them require investigations before tariffs can be imposed. You got Section 232, which basically allows the president to impose tariffs if the Secretary of Commerce finds imports threaten national security. Now, the president can act independently of the recommendations and without a time limit. But there needs to be an investigation done prior to this and a lot of different inquiries done to get to this point. I don't think we have that. That was done in 1962. 1974, we got Section 201. Permits tariffs if the U.S. International Trade Commission finds that a surge in imports harms domestic industries. And that has to do with, for example, dumping, right? We've seen that. Tariffs are usually temporary, about 4 to 8 years. Now, in Section 301, that was also in the Trade Act of 74, that enables the U.S. trade representatives to investigate and impose tariffs on countries with unfair trade practices with presidential approval for at least 4 years. Now, again, we may have had that. That was part of that whole thing they did. But again, the investigations have a process that weren't being utilized. Now, there's three other provisions that allow presidential action without prior investigation. Okay, that's what they used here. The International Emergency Economic Powers Act lets the president declare a national emergency and regulate imports. Now, that's what President Trump did in February of 2025, imposing tariffs on Canada, China, Mexico, etc. Now, the two others that can be used without prior investigation are Section 122, again in the Trade Act of 74, which authorizes temporary tariffs to address serious balance of payment issues. Never been issued, never been used. It's never been used at all. The other one that's never been used is Section 338. That was back in the Tariff Act of 1930, way back in Smoot-Hawley, allows tariffs on goods from countries that discriminate against U.S. commerce. That also has never been used. Now, maybe they will go and try to put these tariffs underneath those particular laws, but I think the courts are really going to have their say on that. So now, what if the tariffs are declared null and void? That's great, right? Well, not really. What? Horowitz is saying that it's not really good when he's been rallying against tariffs forever. You know, back when they were put on the first time with President Trump, and even before that, I've always said the tariffs are a really bad thing if they're not used just for a temporary stopgap, etc. But okay, here's the rub. The tariffs was supposed to be a cornerstone on the ability for us to pay for many of the things that are going on inside the big, beautiful bill. Services that were being either added, taxes that were being held, not really reduced, but reinstated at the lower level as they were going to expire at the end of this year. How are we going to pay for that? Well, it was the big, beautiful bill, which now may be the busted bullshit bill, because as with the tariffs goes this issue that without the excess funds coming in, the question is, how are we going to pay for the continuation of all this? Already it's been explained, reviewed, calculated that this bill is going to cost trillions to the deficit. So how does that all square now? Because markets really were banking on the benefits from the bill's passage. And if you think about it, if nothing else, that sets the stage for another government shutdown and the potential for delaying in passage. Think about that for a second. Because the passage of this may be held up until we get the answers on the tariffs. And that being the case, that could be a while because the courts are not fast. Now, they may be pushed to fast track this. That is probable. I don't see any reason why that wouldn't be the case, especially because there will probably be an injunction on the recent ruling, which allows to keep some of these things on, and there'll be an injunction probably on that as well until this thing goes finally through. But here we are in a situation where we need to do something from a legislative standpoint in order to make sure that we can, by the end of the year, renew the tax cuts, or else they're going up, increase the debt ceiling, or else we're going to have a government shutdown. A lot of big things going on here. So just something to consider. And more than consider, I think the markets are going to have a moment that they're going to be like, oh, what? Wait a second. We didn't think about that. Probably why when the ruling came out and the Dow Jones Industrial Average, initially the futures were up 500-600 points and ended up coming down all the way down. What was that, on last Thursday? And really couldn't hold the level of gains that they had. So that's something that I think is important to consider. Now, before we get to our guest, I want to talk about Interactive Brokers, because I don't want you to be fooled by zero commissions on crypto trades. You know, some brokers add a spread to the price you pay, but at Interactive Brokers, there's no hidden spreads, and you'll pay much less than you would at places like Gemini, Robinhood, or even Fidelity. Keep more pocket and trade crypto for less coin at Interactive Brokers. Now, trading cryptocurrencies involves risk, and it's only for individuals with a high risk tolerance and the financial ability to sustain losses. Compare other brokers' fees and see how much you can save at ibkr.com/crypto. Now let's get to our guest here. Let me introduce him. You know him probably. I've known him for many, 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 many years. It's Barry Ritholtz. He's the co-founder, chairman, and chief investment officer at Ritholtz Wealth Management, which was launched back in 2023, one of the country's fastest growing financial planning and asset management firms. He's called the blog father for creating the Big Picture. That's what it's called. The Big Picture, one of the first market weblogs. That's what we call it. That's what we called it back then. And that site covers everything related to investing. And since its launch in 2003, its mix of behavioral finance and data analytics has attracted nearly 300 million visitors. He's also the creator and host of Masters in Business, the longest running and most popular podcast on Bloomberg Radio. His book, Bailout Nation, was named one of the best business books of the year, selected as the investment book of the year and awarded First Amendment Award for Outstanding Journalism. Now, he has another book, too. We're going to talk about that. It's called How Not to Invest, The Ideas, Numbers, and Behaviors That Destroy Wealth and How to Avoid Them. All right, so Barry Ritholtz is with us today. And, Barry's first time on the show was episode 78. That was back in October of 2008. And Barry, I don't know why this stuck with me over these years. That was years ago. But it stuck with me because I remember when he listened to that show, he called me and you commented, he says, "Why do I sound so nasal?" That's what you said back then.
Because I am nasal. That's the short answer.
It was also the technology back then. I listened to myself and I'm like, oh man, I got to upgrade. I got to do something here to get some better sound here. But the last time you were on was January 16th. So I guess this is the 8 year, and we keep doing 8 years. So this is the 8 years we keep doing this in advance. You have a great book out. We're going to talk about that. It's called How Not to Invest, The Ideas, Numbers, and Behaviors That Destroy Wealth and How to Avoid Them. So, actually, I was real happy because I remember back then, by the way, Barry, you had the greatest blog. I loved it. Started back in 2003 and all that. My show was kind of breaking at the time, right? That was one of the early podcasts, mm-hmm. if you remember, back in 2007. Yeah. And I was so happy when you developed your podcast. I somehow felt a little part of that, you saw the benefit of it. And I'm not taking credit for it, but I'm saying that was a kind of a cool thing that I thought. So, let's go back in time, talk about Barry Ritholtz and ask you, what you were in journalism, you were doing all that. What brought you to the world of finance and investing?
So I was went to originally undergraduate applied math and physics, switched to political science and philosophy, ended up going to law school, which I loved, graduated cum laude, took and passed the New York and New Jersey bars. And suddenly you start doing actual legal work and it's nothing like the erudite intellectual debates you have in law school. It's kind of a grind. And I found myself, frustrated as an attorney because just the day-to-day work is either you love it or you hate it. And I was in the latter case. And one of my clients is a guy named Marty Averbuch, who was running a shop that eventually became the predecessor firm to E-Trade. He ended up being Bill Porter, founder and chairman of E-Trade's right-hand man. But, Marty and his partner, Bill, hired me as a trader. Hey, you're good with numbers. You're good with computers. I was whining about being an attorney. He's like, come do this. So that was mid-90s. I can look up the exact date. I want to say it was right around the Netscape IPO. So whatever you touched went up. You just had to be able to hold it long enough to profit from it. And that led to a fascination with why some people are making money as traders and others aren't, and a fascination with behavioral finance and then economic and market research. And, fast forward a couple of years, suddenly I'm the market strategist for a $7 billion firm named Maxim Group. That was a roll-up that had launched in mid 02, sort of a combination of Herzog and a South African bank Investec and a bunch of other firms. And I just had always been kind of writing on the side to figure out what I think, to organize my thoughts, to put them all in one place. And the small correction, the blog at TypePad launched in 2003, but the original blog was on GeoCities, and that was like 98, something like
GeoCities,
that.
So, wow, that's a blast from the past.
So keep in mind, back in the late 90s, even the early mid 2000s, There was no such thing as Google Docs. There was no Dropbox. There was no Amazon Cloud. If you were back and forth between work and home, or between home and like a weekend house, and you wanted to access a chart, a file, a research piece, unless you physically brought it with you, you couldn't get it. So the blog just kind of operated, especially on GeoCities, which you had to do your own HTML coding. It would take 20 minutes to write something and then an hour and a half to code it. By putting it online, you could always access it wherever you were, even if you're traveling for business. As long as you had an internet connection and a laptop, you could find that chart, that PDF, that what have you. That was like really, really cutting edge and innovative before, you know, Google Drive was ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing how that's all been, you know, these days, you can't even imagine a time when it wasn't like that, right? A time when you had to go to the library and read up on things from Investor's Business Daily is the only place to get it, or Barron's, or, you know, pick your poison of what you were reading. But I remember very distinctly that one of the things I remember over the years, because again, I would say that we go back many, many years, and I always thought of you as someone who wasn't afraid to say what they thought. Now, that may be seeming like, well, what does that mean? But, you know, in our business, you don't want to sometimes step on toes, right? You don't want to say things that maybe someone doesn't like, because then who knows? Maybe they won't become a client, or maybe they won't, you know, maybe they'll leave you as a client, right? But I feel that you never were really afraid to just say your thoughts, whether they're right or wrong, frankly, whatever, it doesn't matter. But you were never afraid to say that. Is that a correct assumption, statement?
Kinda. It's not like I really have a choice. You know, it's not like something annoys me, bothers me. If it's incorrect, I can't help myself. I'll give you probably my favorite example. So I had been jumping up and down about housing and derivatives, you know, mid-2000s, the backwards real estate-driven economy post 01-02. Normal economy, you have a regular expansion, people get jobs and they get raises, then they go buy stuff and they buy houses. Following 9/11 and the dot-com implosion was the bigger economic event. You know, rates came down really low. Jobs and wages have been lagging for a long time, and people just were pulling money out of their homes through HELOCs. It was pretty obvious this was, you know, not traditional. This was kind of backwards. Your home and your equity in your home is not supposed to be used for ordinary consumption like TVs and cars and vacations. You pull HELOC money out to add a second bedroom or fourth bedroom, or to expand the house, or to something that's substantial that adds to the overall value of the house, not regular consumer spending. And every now and then I'd see something that just was so wrong, it would frustrate me. So if you look at the normal cycle for housing bottoms every year, residential real estate bottoms, December, January, it's the worst time of year. It's the darkest, it's the coldest. Even down south, it's the shortest days. And it peaks, you know, June, July, August, and that's because if you close, you know, in June or July, you could move into the new house, even August. If you close early August, you can be in the new house in the new school district in time for your kids to start the new school year on time. And so this is just year after year, you see this pattern. And the Wall Street Journal does a piece, I don't remember, 06, 07. It was after real estate had peaked, but before the market had stock market crashed. And look, housing isn't that bad. It's better from February to March. It's better from March to April. It's better from April to May. And I send an email to the editors. Hey, you know, you guys are not recognizing the seasonality of real estate. It's always better February to March, March to April, April to May. If you really want to see what's going on, look at it March 07 to March 06 to March 05. You could see a dramatic decrease in sales, no seasonal effect. You know, this is economics 101. Figure this out. They refused to correct it. So I wrote a whole long piece explaining seasonality in home prices. And unfortunately, the former French literature majors who are editing the Wall Street Journal don't understand basic mathematics, basic probabilities. Now, by the way, in the ensuing 20, 25 years, basically financial media has gotten a lot better. It still has issues, but the old days of just taking a green kid and throwing him on the employment desk or the covering the Fed or whatever, that doesn't really happen. We've seemed to have created a little more sophistication and expertise, but I'm constantly looking at headlines that make me spit up my coffee, and you'll see a lot of that stuff in the book. So some people have said, oh, you're fearless. You say what you want. It's like, I don't have a choice. If that pebble is in my shoe, I got to get it out.
Yeah, I agree with you. I just felt, you know, it's just, I was always very impressed by your ability to cut through the nonsense is the point. A lot of people won't. A lot of people, you know, a lot of people just also will just go by whatever's there. You know, just whatever happens. Whatever is said is truth. And you were able to cut right through that, which was awesome. And obviously a testament to you and reasons for your success. The podcast, Masters in Business. So you've been doing that for a number of years. You've had some incredible people on that show. And, you know, tell me about, you know, what is maybe some of your favorite guests? You've had some big names, obviously.
Sure.
Do you actually do that from the Bloomberg Studios or do you?
Yes, they insist that it's in person, face to face. Other than like 20 months during the pandemic, they were all, everybody's right there. It's a very different conversation when you could read someone's body language and kind of schmooze a little bit. It came about because I was writing for the Washington Post after the book Bailout Nation, and Bloomberg came around, started recruiting me. They offered me a daily television show, and I'm like, I don't have anything to say every day. That sounds like a lot of clickbait and a lot of filler. Well, what do you want to do? I don't know. I'd like to sit down and have adult conversations with intelligent, successful people and ask them real questions, not the usual TV bullshit questions. I don't care where the market's going to be in a year. Honestly, I don't care what their favorite stock is. And I have no interest in their prediction of when the next Fed cut is going to be. So what do you want to ask them? Who they are? How did they get that way? Who are their mentors? What are their favorite books? What advice do they wish they were given when they were younger? What do they know today they didn't know 30 years ago when they were first starting out? And so, what do you mean by long form? Bloomberg said. And I said, you know, 2 hours. And when everybody finished laughing, they said, tell you what, get us 32 minutes. That's an hour of radio and everything else we'll just put up online. The first year, so I signed with Bloomberg in 2013. The podcast launched July 2014. So we're like 11, almost 12 years in. And the first year, not only did I have to just beg friends, colleagues, anybody whose email address or phone number I could find to come on, what's a podcast?
Oh, please.
But it was really, I'll tell you, it was really, I was really awful. And the head of radio, Al Mayer, used to pull me aside each week and sort of do a post-mortem and go over stuff. And, you know, I was just all caffeine and adrenaline running through. Well, I would prepare 8 hours of questions for 90 minutes to 2 hours. And so I was always just, you know, full of, you know, just caffeine and adrenaline and running through the list. And I'll never forget one day Al pulls me aside and says, now, listen, when a guest tells you he murdered his wife and buried her in the basement, don't just go to the next question. Why did you murder her? Yeah. How did you do it? How did you get away? How come nobody found you in this time? You know, I like to jokingly say, if you want to confess to a felony, do so in the last 5 minutes of a podcast. Nobody will ever know. But still, the idea that, oh, wait, I have to listen to the guests and respond. It, you know, like anything else, it's just a matter of reps. You do enough of these and you just get better and better and better at it. And, you know, sometime around the middle of the second or third year, like, oh, I hear like this is now getting better. But people would be surprised at how awful you have to be before you start showing signs of improvement.
Yeah, I remember my first podcast back in 2007. I would spend the same amount of time with all this written paper in front of me, and I pretty much just read it. And it was I thought it was interesting, but it's probably so boring. But it ended up working out very nicely. But so when you do these podcasts and you know, you're at Bloomberg, you do they still have the free food on the sixth floor?
Of course, they do. Keep in mind, Bloomberg is so data driven. Not only is the sixth floor where all the elevators go, they track what products. Hold on one sec. I'm going to shut this dog off. Not only is there that whole run of food and cappuccino and coffee and tea and flavored waters and all that stuff, they know exactly what moves more of what product and what moves less. They know exactly how many hours of productivity per dollar spent they have. I think there's like 8,000 employees in that building. Imagine 8,000 people going out to coffee twice a day or going out for a snack. Like if they spend $1 million a week, I guarantee you it's $4 million a week in productivity savings. They are very sophisticated. Hey, they are a giant data analytics company. And so they crunch the numbers. Yep. By the way, I never answered your question. Who were my favorite guests?
Yes, I was going to get there.
Yeah, who all right. So I just kind of gave you the genesis of the pod. So feel free to ask that whenever you feel it's fair.
Go ahead. I'll listen right now.
There's so many. It's so, you know, I just kind of, so the first time I had Ray Dalio on, he was known as a prickly interviewer. He just was kind of tight and shockingly, you know, usually these guys show up right on time. They leave right on time. He got there like a half hour early and we were just bullshitting a little bit beforehand. In fact, we had done a pre-call and he had said to me, you don't look familiar. This was on a phone call. I told him where I had met him at St. Pat's Church. He had done a speech and a Q&A with Michael McKee. And it doesn't ring a bell. As soon as he saw me on the sixth floor by the food, he's like, I remember you. And so we just started schmoozing. And by the time we sat down to do the podcast, he was just so loose and comfortable. It was really awesome. Mm. So all of the behavioral finance guys, Schiller, Fama, Thaler, Gilovich, go down the whole list. I've pretty much Kahneman twice, Thaler maybe three times, Cass Sunstein. All those folks I've had on they're always fascinating. They're always really interesting. Ken Feinberg, the special master who oversaw the 9/11 Victims Fund, as well as the Volkswagen Dieselgate and the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. He was really just absolutely fascinating. Probably the most amusing one was a live one I did not too long ago with Michael Lewis. I've been fortunate enough to interview Michael as the author of The Big Short and Moneyball and Liar's Poker and all that stuff. I've had him on for each one of his last six books, plus a couple of live ones here, one at an ETF conference, one at another conference. So I've interviewed him 10 times. And last month when his new book came out, we did a live event at a small 300-person theater in Port Washington. And I don't know, we were just both kind of loose. And I thought I heard every story he has to tell. He told stories I never heard before that were hilarious. Mm. And he's not one who usually curses, but he was telling stories about Billy Bean and Brad Pitt, just laden with F-bombs and so funny. And just, it was, if someone says, give me one of your podcasts to listen to, what would you recommend? I would say that recent Michael Lewis live at the Port Washington Theater, because I've never heard any of that stuff, and I've heard all of his shtick. Wow. So it was new to me, and it was hilarious. It was really great.
You know, it's funny because I wonder if you have the same experience, but some of the biggest names that I thought were the biggest names at the time, like some of the people in the Treasury or government, they happen to be the worst guests I've ever had. Do you find that sometimes it's like they have nothing to say but the data? And you can't like even draw it out of them? Has that been your experience?
So here's the challenge. You're raising a valid point, but I'm gonna yes, but, or as opposed to yes, and. So I really make a serious effort to not listen to other. If I have a guest coming up next week, I don't want to hear the podcast they're on. I want to do my own research. I don't want to steal other people's questions. You know, I've kind of seen people stealing my questions, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to know what their answers are. I kind of want to be able to keep it organic and work my way through. So some of the things you kind of learn is that you really have to do a deep, deep dive into someone's background. If they're a little dry, if they're a little wonky, if they're a little data-driven, you have to find those little sentences, those little quotes from them that'll start them on a different sort of tread. And, you know, it gets easier as you do it longer and longer. I kind of had to teach myself to, if someone's a little dry, if someone's a little technical, all right, well, then I have to wade into that water and get technical with them. Technical with them, but force them to define their terms, to explain what various acronyms mean, to discuss data in a way. You know, my rule of thumb has always been, my wife teaches fashion illustration and design and art. My mom is a real estate agent. Like, they need to understand this. And so that's always been my target audience. So anybody who starts getting really wonky, I try and, you know, at least bring it down to the level of a sophisticated investor. The people who are really data-driven, I tend to know that in advance, and I try and tee up questions that will make the data have some context and framing and understandable to the average investor. So let me just give you a perfect example. So this week coming up, I have Tom Barkin. He's the president of the Richmond Federal Reserve. He's a member of the Federal Open Market Committee that sets rates. I think he spent something like 31 years at McKinsey. Not only was he the chief risk officer, but he was the chief financial officer. So here's a guy that, you know, you want to get wonky and go into the weeds, you can. But a lot of his quotes, a lot of the things that I found when I was doing research were just really accessible. And so he describes monetary policy as being data-driven, but you have to balance conviction and humility. Mm. That's a perfect. Tell us about how you balance conviction and humility. Who can't relate to that?
Mm-hmm.
He in one of his Q&A somewhere, he described the economic environment as foggy. And so when I asked him about that, he gave this wonderful metaphor of, hey, when it's a bright sunny day, you're driving down the highway, the top is down, you're doing 60 miles an hour, you're making great progress. Sometimes the weather is bad, it's really foggy out. You don't want to go too fast, you'll hit the person in front of you, you can't see. You don't want to go too slow, the person behind you will plow into you. You need to find the right speed relative to the weather conditions so that you can navigate safely. And when you get a guy who is, you know, deeply entrenched in economic policy and monetary policy, who can speak with that sort of just accessible, well understood sort of language, you got to lean heavily into it. It also turns out he's an avid golfer and he served on the USGA board. So I got to say, hey, you have a really fascinating region. It's DC, it's Virginia, it's all these states right around DC. What's your home golf course? Where do you play? And how does golf affect the way you look at the economy? And he goes on this great thing about, this is my favorite course, but I also like this public course. And we look at how prices are going up in golf courses and how busy they are. And it led to this whole set of anecdotes that really fleshed out who he was. And so, again, it just kind of comes back to doing the reps. The more you do it and the more self-critical you are, the better it ends up being. Like, I have to listen. I listen to each of these podcasts 3 times. I do. The first listen is really just my prep and thinking it through. And I work with a research assistant, Sean Russo, who really helps with the first draft of questions. And then I pass through it a second time on my own. And then I'll run it through some other software and some AI to see if I missed anything. And ultimately, so that's the first run. Then I actually sit through the podcast and try and pay attention while we're recording it. And then because it's Bloomberg and it goes out over the radio and there's FCC rules about cursing and things, I audit it a third time, even though I know an engineer and an editor are going to audit it. Every now and then I'll catch a bullshit that slips by. Mm-hmm. And you can, you know, it's a big fat fine if you say, forget the F-bomb, if you just say ass or shit on the air. So you really have to be careful for stuff that's broadcast. And, you know, you kind of develop the muscles to be self-critical. And where am I talking too much? Is this a bad question? What opportunities did I miss? Like, I'm pretty active listener trying to find out how could I have made this a little better. Sometimes you get a guest, and I have some hilarious stories that I'll tell you off air about guests that were just, you know, I love when someone says, you ask them this sophisticated, insightful question, and the answer is nope. I mean, what do you do with that? Yeah. At a certain point, I had a very famous fund manager who had, notoriously crashed and burned multiple times. And every question I asked was like an existential crisis where I would ask the question and he would go, and then he would slowly answer the question. And I have the engineer in my ear saying, none of this is usable. This is terrible. And I kind of had to say, we'll edit out the dead spaces. Don't worry. So a 90-minute conversation became like 37 minutes. And it was painful, but you know, we made it listenable. And when someone has made and lost a fortune several times, I'd like to think there are some lessons in that for the rest of us.
Yep. You know, how great is it though? Because I do guests all the time as well. So I know this is a fact and I'm pre-answering this for you, but how great is it having the opportunity to speak to some of the greatest minds in our business and out there? And the wealth of knowledge, selfishly, that you get from that.
Oh my God! First of all, just the recording is the most fun I have all week, and I'm fond of saying I have the greatest gig in finance podcasting. I have a producer who does all the scheduling. I have an engineer that makes sure the recording is great. I have an editor who cleans it up. I kind of just show up. Hey, I'm here. Bring me somebody spectacular. Great. And then I get to spend an hour and a half, 2 hours with them. So I love that. On top of that, I have found that, you know, very often somebody will change my mind about something. So Bill McNabb, former CEO and chairman of Vanguard, it was right after Flash Boys had come out. Everybody was very down on high frequency trading. It seemed like, oh my God, they've removed the people. This is just, everybody is front running. This is a disaster. And Bill McNabb says, I don't know what all the criticism. We're super cost conscious at Vanguard, and high frequency trading has reduced spreads, increased liquidity. It's lowered our total cost of execution and trading. We're thrilled with it. Hey, when the guy who's running one of the largest low-cost index and active shops in the world, I think they're like up to $9 trillion. When he says this is great for our business and great for our customers, you could either double down or say, maybe I'm wrong. And so that, you know, I find that I'm constantly rethinking my ideas. I often go back to first principles. It's crucial.
But isn't that a great lesson actually for everybody listening? How the idea is to listen with an open ear, not to just, you know, I think one of the things that, you know, I think we've talked about this in the past, the echo chambers, you know, the confirmation biases, the behavioral finance part of things where we want to believe what we want to believe, right? Not what's real, or we've at least what we think is real. But isn't that the greatest thing when you can have that ability to listen openly? And I think listeners can take that away, this conversation, and say, well, maybe that's something I could work on, being more open, being more able to be sponge-like versus having a hard outer shell and accepting of other ideas that maybe can benefit me.
I'm trying to remember which guest it was who, you know, and there is a little bit of, you know, bias. And if I'm picking behavioral economics professors and have them come into the studio, that, you know, I'm sort of primed to like what they say. But at a certain point, like the agreement had just gotten so ridiculous, I kind of interrupted the podcast and said, today's recording is brought to you by confirmation bias. Yes, confirmation bias, seeking out only the things that we agree with. And it was funny, and I don't even remember if the editors kept it in, but it was just, I you know, some of the most memorable ones are either people who, whether I agree or disagree with them, they have a very distinct point of view. Scott Galloway is a perfect example and, you know, can articulate that point of view very well. Or someone like Mike Green, who is a very intelligent, articulate, informed person who's very much, who has had a number of fantastic calls in his career. We completely disagree on the value of broad indexes as a source of market stress. And, you know, I love finding someone who I respect their process, but disagree with their conclusion. So I can, you know, legitimately have a debate about an issue. And, you know, ultimately I didn't get Mike Green to say indexing is fine. It's going to be here forever and it's not causing a problem that has yet to manifest itself. But he did say, look, when I speak to friends and family members and they say, what should I do with my money? I tell them to put it in a broad index. And so I'm as guilty as anyone else. He just thinks it's going to cause an eventual structural problem. I push back. Didn't we hear that in 08, 09, the flash crash, the pandemic, 2022? It has not caused a problem after 15, 20 years. At what point does the warnings kind of, you know, no longer are they a legitimate alarm? So being able to debate that with him, have a conversation with him, that was fascinating.
I want to segue over to your book because we keep talking about this, especially about, you know, cognitive biases and decision-making. And I know there's a lot of stuff you want to talk about, but some of this is in the book also. In fact, and just to restate this point, I got it right in front of me. I'm holding it right now, by the way. How not to invest, the ideas, numbers, and behaviors that destroys wealth and how to avoid them. Very well done, by the way. And I like how you... what we call this? It's like a three-act play. You made it, sectioned it, right? So it's not just chapter after chapter after chapter. And you actually have an area in here where you talk about people, you know, how to use the book, how you could use the book, or how not to use the book, or, you know, do what you want with it. So it's great. Well done. I love it. A lot of great niblets, stories, anecdotes. And I think you really did a good job at helping people face truths that are out there in a very interesting way. So a couple of things that come to mind first. For years, you've been talking about how to invest, right? These ideas of, you know, you should do this, or maybe we just talked about index investing as a good idea. You know, you've written about that. You've talked about that. But now you flip the script, right? And you talk about how not to invest. Tell me a little bit about what kind of brought this idea up to kind of go to the other side and bring the same discussion of actually how to invest with the idea of what you shouldn't be doing.
So a couple of things. I'll give you three little bullet points that ultimately led to the book, three or four. So first, Bailout Nation was 2009. We launched Ritholtz Wealth Management in 2013. And, you know, by the time it was 2014, 15, 16, friends, family members, publishers were like, hey, when's the next book? And I'm like, I'm busy. I don't have time for a book. And besides, there are tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of investing books, and they don't really seem to be helping because most people are still really bad investors, at best mediocre. And, you know, the average investor is below average, if that's remotely possible, I guess, compared to both their own investments and to their benchmarks. There's a chapter later on that explains how people manage to underperform their own investments, which I find hilarious. So that was the first thing. It's like, do we really need another book telling people buy this, sell that? It's just a waste of time. And then the second thing that came along is I had been reading Charlie Munger for forever, and I found this comment that he made that just perfectly sums up who he is. Charlie Munger, famously Warren Buffett's partner in Berkshire Hathaway. I think he continued working right up until he passed away at age 97. Yep. Yep. Someone at one of the I think it was at one of the Berkshire Hathaway sort of Woodstocks in Omaha asked him, are you and Warren just smarter than everybody else? And Charlie says, no, absolutely not. In fact, our advantage is not that we're smarter than everybody else. We're just less stupid, which is such a perfect Charlie Mungerism, because it's both like shockingly blunt and true. Warren himself has said, you know, any IQ points in investing over 125 are wasted. But the idea that you don't have to be smarter, you just need to be less stupid, kind of led me to a book that I had read a long time ago by the great Charlie Ellis, who chairman of the Yale Endowment, board of directors on Vanguard, as well as he ran Greenwich Associates, just a legendary guy. He wrote a paper in the 1970s that became a book, I think in the early 90s, called Winning the Loser's Game. And so Ellis explains why investing is like tennis. You know, other than the 0.01% of people who are professional tennis players, you know, those guys, the pros, they win by scoring points. They serve aces, they hit with power, with spin, with accuracy. They kiss the line, they keep the ball away from the sweet spot of their opponent. Those are, you know, the Federers and the Nadals. The rest of us hackers, well, we don't win by scoring points. Mm-hmm. We lose by making unforced errors.
Right.
We double fault on the serve. We hit it out. We hit it wide. We hit it into the net. We hit it right into the sweet spot of our opponent's swing. These are all silly mistakes that, if you just return the ball and get it over the net, the odds are that if you're playing with someone who's plus or minus 20, 25% of your skill level, making fewer mistakes will lead you to win. I play with a bunch of young guys. They're faster. They're stronger. They hit much harder than me. They're also, you know, 20, 30 years my junior. And I regularly beat them because they're dying to crush the ball. Yep. They're dying to serve aces. And it's like if they just throttled it back 10%, they would kick my ass, but they can't help themselves. And especially if I play on a Monday night after there's been like the US Open or the Australian Open, where you're watching these guys,
you're all jammed up.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Like you're watching these guys and they come in and they just want to destroy the ball 6-0, 6-0, 6-0 and out. It's like, hey, and I want to tell them, I have to fight the urge to say, why don't you just play within yourself? And so Charlie Ellis brilliantly applies this to investing and says, instead of trying to find the next NVIDIA or to tap out in October 07 and jump back in March 09, instead, just make fewer mistakes. You know, don't worry about picking stocks. Nobody's all that good at it. Certainly not selling them. Don't worry about market timing. Just own a broad index and rebalance every few years and manage your own behavior. If you don't have the right temperament, you're going to do poorly in this. And so, you know, those were the three things that kind of teed up my thought process. And then the pandemic hits and I kind of have a little bit of extra time because I'm not commuting 4 days a week into the city. So I have this giant bulletin board in my office and I just start on these 3x5 index cards, just start writing down different chapter ideas and chapter titles and just putting them up on the bulletin board. And, you know, I must have had 150. And I just start organizing them and they sort of organize themselves into really three. You mentioned the book is in three acts. The three broad categories just kind of became, here are bad ideas and here's how they spread. Here are all the numbers that people fail to understand and why. And all of this manifests itself in bad behavior. And those three broad categories made me realize, oh, you know, rather than tell people what to do, let's just avoid these unforced errors. And here are the things that we really should be focused on not doing instead of the things that we should be trying to do. And hence, you know, when I went to search how not to invest, there literally was not a single book with that title. I was genuinely shocked. And now there's my book and 100 fake versions of it on Amazon.
It's funny you mentioned that because I looked it up at Amazon. I'm like, what is that? Like, so I really didn't understand,
It's a free rider problem. Yeah. One of them has my name on it. It looks like
it's got your picture on it.
I wrote
your
it.
Picture.
Yeah, well, that's a different one. Oh. And it's like, you know, so I just put I had to put a single review on it. Hey, FYI, this is not me. If you want to read the book I actually wrote, How Not to Invest, here's the link to Amazon. Knock yourself out. Mm. And, you know, I think the paperback will be out a year from now, sometime early May 2026. We'll go through the same headache. You know, it's funny. If you're going to steal my book, at least spell my name right. I'm kind of shocked. That, like, I know AI is not great. And all these books are just AI scrapes. The way they get around the copyright law is the workbook, How Not to Invest workbook, which of course is just bullshit. They're just AI garbage.
I mean, the same thing.
It is what it is. It's disappointing. Yeah, it's disappointing that Amazon. So Cory Doctorow of Boing Boing, and he's also a sci-fi writer, have written a number of really great books. He calls it I call it platform decay. He calls it crapification. And wherever you look, eBay, Amazon, look at Google, any major platform eventually becomes a victim of its own success. Like I use Google. I was such an early, I was a beta tester of Google search back in the, I don't know, late 90s, early 2000s. I remember sending him an email. Hey, if you're looking for some money, I'd love to help you raise. And they were like, we're fine. Don't worry. We're good. But Google went from this PageRank was the single greatest innovation in the internet to it's just now completely crapified. The same is true for Amazon. Amazon search is garbage. Every page is festooned with ads. I'm searching for a specific lithium battery for a car fob, a key fob for a car. And if I'm searching for that exact model number, you would think the first one that pops up is that model number. Mm-hmm. And I failed to look that it's not 451, but it's 972 and it's the wrong one. So they ship it to me. Hey, you asshole, serve me up the wrong one. I failed to notice it because who would do that? It's such a specific search. Take it back. And it was like $5, but it must have cost them God knows how much to ship it to and fro. And, you know, Amazon is not what it used to be. eBay is a total shit show. Their eBay guarantee, I've heard countless stories about it's an algorithm and it just, you know, hey, this never arrived. Well, the post office said it did. Yeah, that's why you don't ask the surgeon who botched the operation what went wrong. You ask somebody else. Mm-hmm. It never arrived. Don't ask the person you paid to deliver it. So I've heard countless stories about eBay. I don't know who's buying $20,000 and $30,000 watches on eBay. I think light that money on fire. And then, you know, I don't know how much Google's traffic has dropped, but search for something on Google, you got to go like two or three pages into it. So that whole platform decay, that whole crapification, it's an issue. And this, you know, what you see with these fakes and these AI generated nonsense. You know, to me, if I was, I guess I can't even say Jeff Bezos, it's whoever, what's his name? Jassy, who's
Andy
running?
Andy Jassy.
Yeah. Like if I was him, it's like, hey, you know, you've spent 25 years building trust and you have completely blown trust. I used to always start looking for stuff on Amazon if I wanted to order something. Maybe this is a little leftover from the pandemic, but, you know, you kind of set up accounts everywhere. Mm-hmm. They're no longer my go-to. I guess they're making money on search and ads, but Is that offsetting the money that they're getting, what that they're losing from people? So I've been a regular subscribe and save user for I don't know how long. And, you know, it's they constantly don't have stuff available. It's kind of amazing to see how they've gone from the single greatest thing in retail to meh. I don't really care.
I mean, it's still the easiest in a way. They're still very easy to deal with. That's the thing they have. But the prices aren't necessarily good.
Oh, no, the price, they used to be the low cost. Yeah, they're not even anymore. Remotely close. Anything I order for the dogs, I usually look at Chewy. They keep canceling subscribe. Like, I know I'm going to need this many milk bones and this many poop bags. And they keep canceling stuff. I'm just about ready to switch all of the dog stuff over to Chewy. Yeah. And so my subscribe and save used to be like, this is the crap we order every month. And, but this is not specific to Amazon or eBay or Google. This is the innovator's dilemma. This is eventually we all become victims of our own success. And that's really deeply problematic. And there's nothing you could do about it. It's just the nature of things.
Yep. I want to get back to the book here. I want to talk about, because I was going to talk to you about the cars. I feel like there was a time that you were looking for a car. I know you like cars. There was a car you were looking at, I remember, that I was going to go see for some reason somewhere. It was like an old Mustang or something. Does that ring a bell?
Sure. I don't think it was a Mustang, but something. I don't remember what it was.
Anyway.
So, you know, I had to stop writing about cars when I was writing the book, and I'm just about to start doing that. I love to find, you know, I guess deep down inside, I'm a value investor. I love to find these old sort of overlooked cars and sort of bring them back up to spec. And so it's actually a footnote in the book. I did it. Probably the most recent one I did was converting a 300,000 mile 1987 Porsche 911 that the previous owner had owned it for like 30 years, had an accident like 20 years ago. And redid it. And so it, you know, the paint, the exterior, the interior were in perfect shape, but it had 300,000 miles on it. No one's going to put $50,000 into bringing that back up to mechanically up to spec. So I had the dumb idea of let's convert this to an EV. And basically there's a shop in Austin, Texas called Moment Motors. And I have the first electric Porsche 911 in New York State.
What color?
So that's kind of fun.
What color?
It's called Lagoon Green Metallic. It's really like a very light blue. Mm. If you go to Ritholtz.com and just search 911 EV, you'll not only see pictures of it, but the whole process, how they added stuff. I tried to document, but I've done this with a bunch of cars. I did this with an 88 911 Cabrio. I did it with a 77 FJ40, the old Toyota truck that looks like a Jeep. I did it with a 2013 Jeep that was a flood car, but it was in perfect shape. All it needed was all the electrical harnesses replaced. The Jeep is sort of dumb simple. There's a hamster wheel and a pulley, and that's what makes it go. So the electrics, literally, you have the central fuse box and then three distinct wiring harnesses that come off of that. One that controls the engine, one that controls all the lights, and the third that control all of the, you know, interior stuff. And so it's not that expensive to replace all three of those. And Jeeps are notoriously expensive. They hold their value really well. So I ended up, I think all in, that Jeep was a two-door Rubicon with a stick shift that I bought a year old. Maybe it was a Sandy flood car. I don't remember. In 2014, all in, 20 grand. Those were going for 40 grand. So It's not the money. It's like, how can I, and you will recognize this from the book, the podcast, the writings. How can I identify something that everybody is somehow overlooking and find some value that is missed? And for the most part, markets are mostly kind of sort of efficient. But every now and then there's something that goes either overlooked or misunderstood, or, you know, the only problem I've had with that Jeep is like 8 years later, the radio had to be replaced. Other than that, it's been pretty flawless.
That's something. That's something. Listen, I'm going to ask you, we're kind of coming up, button up against the time limit here. I'm going to talk to you about the three different sections, acts. I'm going to ask you one question about each of those, and we're going to kind of rapid fire these a bit because I want to get through these, okay?
Sure, fire away.
On bad ideas. Though, one of the things you talk about is filtering out noise from the nonstop floodgate of an open fire hydrant. I'm saying this part. Open fire hydrant of news that comes all the time. You know, these days, I'm woken up in the middle of the night, you know, during the Trump era. You're woken up during the middle of the night for some news that's popping on CNBC or whatever on my phone. How do you get to filter some of this out, or maybe even and social media for that matter, so that you can kind of deal with this all a lot better? How should investors look at this?
Sure. So I grew up of the era where our parents used to tell us, don't take candy from strangers, right? Pretty obvious. Yeah. You're a kid. You shouldn't do that. Well, if you're paying attention to radio, television, newspaper, magazine, internet, social media, it doesn't matter. You got to ask yourself, am I taking candy from a stranger or not? And the short answer is probably, if you're just blindly listening to randos on whatever. But here's the question you have to ask yourself. Hey, who is this person who's proffering this information? What's their track record? Do they have a process? Is there some thought about this? Have they lived through a few cycles? What's their temperament when the shit hits the fan? Do they run around panicking with their hair on fire, or are they, you know, the voice of reason? Are they cool and collected? You know, I don't expect people to bat 1,000 to get everything right, but are they more right than wrong? Is their process defendable? And so once you start asking those questions, suddenly it's, why am I reading this columnist? Why am I listening to this podcast? Why am I watching this show on this television channel or listening to this radio show or this pundit? You know, I think we all need to be a little less gullible and a little less naive. And be aware, everybody is trying to sell you something. Mm-hmm. At least understand their biases, their motivations, before you accept at face value what somebody is saying. If you would have listened to the people who in early April, you know, in late March said, Trump is a disaster, the tariffs are going to cause a depression, the stock market's going to crash. You know, you got out. Here we are. What are we, 4%, 5% above Liberation Day? Yep. And what were the odds that you were going to time it right and see the tweet from Trump that said, buy stocks today? I mean, he says that all the time. So how do you know which one to pay attention to?
Yeah. I mean, talk about skipping to bad numbers. I want to there's two things I was thinking about was your discussion about economic numeracy or how people can think more probabilistically, right? Less reactively when it comes to market data. So, but I think we just kind of covered that a little bit to a degree. So let's talk about economic numeracy and maybe one of the metrics that people can think about that maybe you believe are the most commonly misunderstood.
So the two biggest ones are the recency effect. We pay too much attention on the most recent data point. And the effect of compounding both on investments and things like inflation. And everything needs context and framing. And you have to realize that the world isn't black and white. There are shades of gray. And if you keep that in mind, I'll just give you a quick example of each. So everybody loses their mind each month over non-farm payrolls, the TV in the corner is the countdown, like it's a launch to put a man on the moon. It's just so stupid. And if you understand how the data is put together, all right, so the United States has 350 million people, and about half of them are in the labor force. Of that, pick a number, 168, 174 million people. Each month, almost 4 million people start a new job. They graduate. They return from sabbatical, whatever. They start a new job. In the same month, about 4 million people quit, retire, go on maternity leave, take a sabbatical, die. And the net difference between those two numbers, 200, 150, 300,000 of the two $4 million person pools out of 175 million people in the labor force out of 350 million people, that's the non-farm payroll report. Now, that's before We get the first adjustment, the second adjustment, the subsequent model adjustment a year and a half later. It's a noisy, tiny rounding error. It's not meaningful other than when there's a significant change in the underlying trend. And so to hang on to television every first Friday of the month is a waste of time. So that's just recency effect. That's a simple number. Inflation always cracks me up. My favorite meme is the Home Alone, the Kevin, what's his last name? McAllister. Mm-hmm. Kevin, the kid from Home Alone, who famously goes to the supermarket and buys $19 worth of grocery. And, you know, if you would buy that today in 2025, that $19 bag is going to cost you, I don't remember, $57 or $72. Mm-hmm. And anybody who shares that is either a numerate or a propagandist, because it's the single biggest load of bullshit in all of economics. And let me, three quick reasons why. So first, I don't know about you, but when I go to the supermarket in 2025, I'm using the money I earned in 2025. I don't have an envelope from 1990 that I've saved in order to go shopping in 2025.
Yeah.
So there's no inflation. I earned it today. I spent it tomorrow. Bang. But secondly, everything is double entry accounting. There's costs and expenses. There's liabilities and assets. So if the cost of that basket went from $19 to $72, how much has my wages and earnings on average gone up? And it turns out that the median wage has gone up more than that basket of groceries. So effectively, if Kevin is fast forwarded to 2025, that basket of groceries is cheaper today than it was in 1990, which is just fact. You can look this stuff up. This is not opinion. You either understand this or you're wrong. There's no gray. Most things are areas of gray. Reasonable people can disagree. There's no debate here. If your wages have gone up more than the cost of goods, well, then the cost of goods is cheaper, full stop. But then lastly, if Kevin would have said, you know, instead of putting $19 into these groceries, I'm going to invest it. Well, 35 years later, that $19 is worth almost $500. And so he could buy the $75 basket of goods today and still have, you know, whatever, $325 left over. So money is not, money is a medium of exchange. It's not a store of value. Every time I see this, it's, you know, if you would have buried $100 in a mason jar in your backyard 100 years ago, it would have lost 96% of the value. And the correct answer is your great grandfather was a fucking moron for burying that money. In the book, I have an example of two guys go off to war. They both have $1,000. One buries it in mason jars and the other invested in the market. Okay, 100 years later, $1,000 buried in the backyard, it's lost 96% of its value. But that's not because the dollar is somehow flawed. It's because great-grandpappy was a doofus. The guy who invested that money, I always ask people to guess what it's worth. The number shocks them. $1,000 compounded over a century is about $32 million. Mm. Just figure it out with the rule of 72. I show a chart in the book. So on the one hand, did it technically lose 96% of its value? Yes, but only if grandpa was a moron. If he was a savvy investor, it's worth $32 million. Do the math. And sometimes, you know, this isn't college calculus. This is high school level arithmetic. It's just that compounding is so counterintuitive. We don't understand how to manage it.
But that also goes back to the first point about the issue of filtering out financial media, not eliminating, but filtering out the drama, filtering out the headlines, filtering out, as you talked about, spitting up coffee when you're reading headlines, which I can imagine what those are, you know, talking about some things that are just clickbait and trying to get us to read the article versus giving us a snippet of facts so that we're interested. You know, it's a much different art. There's, as we know, there's people that write headlines for a living because that's what they do. And that, you know, they're the equivalent of commercials to 2.5 hour movies. So the point here is that much of what you're saying here is the stuff that is brought to us by whoever it is that's trying to win us over in this bad notion of economics so that they can, I don't know, either sell us something or we're reading something or believing what they're saying, buying gold, buying Bitcoin, who knows, right?
Yeah, 100%. This goes back to what we said earlier. Don't take candy from strangers. Yep. If you don't know who they are, well, find out before you say, oh, I'm going to do X or Y in response to what they said. It's not that complicated. Hey, humans are social primates. We have mostly benefited as a cooperative species, at least for the first 2 million years of human existence and evolution. The problem is, once you bring in market effects and people trying to sell you a product, well, they can take advantage of our naivete and our desire for cooperation. Hey, we have neither fangs nor fur, nor fangs nor talons, nor armor, nor claws. So the only way we have survived and thrived as a soft, chewy, delicious mammal is by cooperating. And because we are a cooperative species, salespeople and media folks generally can take advantage of the fact that, you know, we want to cooperate.
Mm-hmm. Finally, on your last chapter on bad behavior, you talk about this idea that investing is simple, but it's hard. And that a lot of people make mistakes. They make stupid mistakes. We're talking about grandpa with his mason jar. We're talking about people listening to stock tips from strangers and getting that information. What's the most common trap behaviorally? That investors experience. What is the most common kind of area or the genre of trap that they will fall into?
So there's they're all kind of different sides of the same coin. So obviously fear and greed is a big thing. Chasing a stock up, you know, seeing your idiot neighbor down the street get rich makes you crazy. I got to own what he owns. That's one. Panic selling into a crash. There's a chapter in the book that explains 31% of people who panic sell never return to equities. Mm-hmm. Think about what that means following the financial crisis. And then, you know, one of the best 15-year periods in market history that followed it. But really, it's just a matter of managing your own behavior, finding the right temperament, and thinking long-term. And here's the problem with 24/7 media and endless Substacks and blogs and podcasts and radio and TV is what happens on a random Thursday in May is completely irrelevant to your portfolio that you're not going to touch for 10, 20, 30 years. In fact, I love to show people a chart that includes the 87 crash. And if you're showing them a 40, 50 year chart, you can't even see the 87 crash. And P.S., you know, it was barely a year later, you were already above the level that the crash started from. And so if you panic out, if you give in to your limbic system, finance is not a good thing for you. You have to be the master of your domain. If not, you're going to suffer painful losses or the lack of sort of growth that leads to comfortable retirements.
Good stuff. Barry Ritholtz, co-founder, chairman, and chief investment officer of Ritholtz Wealth Management, author, How Not to Invest, the ideas, numbers, and behaviors that destroy wealth, and how to avoid them. By the way, you know, we go back to the nasal discussion. My first book that I wrote, The Disciplined Investor, they asked me to narrate it. Oh, that was horrible. That was, first of all, it's painful.
I literally did a post on reading the book for the Audible version.
Oh.
Because it was, first of all, the first day you just leave with an incredible headache. And then the second day you kind of learn. So I'm a New Yorker, so I tend to talk to the back of the room and I tend to talk fast and blah, blah, blah. You kind of learn that you have to speak slowly and speak quietly. Otherwise, you lose your voice. And you're only doing it like 4.5 hours in a day because that's all you got. Like you get there, you do an hour, you take a 15-minute break, you do an hour, you take a lunch break, you do an hour. And I'm like, let's just grab some tea and power through. Aside from the fact that the mic picks up your stomach gurgling every time you move.
Smacking the lips.
Clothes rustle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no milk in the coffee because dairy makes your lips and tongue sticky. Like, who knew this? And it's funny. I recorded this at, I forgot the name. Was it Macmillan? It was one of the big places. It was downtown. And I'm looking at all the titles on the shelves. And a lot of them are read by the author, but there's like the same five names narrated by, you see the same people. It's like, oh, this is really a skill. This is really a talent to be able to bring, you know, it's really hard. The thing that shocked me more than anything was learning how many words I have never said out loud and only know from reading or writing and had to really figure out how to pronounce. We always say market cap. We never say capitalization, which I can now say, but it took 10 attempts to say capitalization.
Yeah.
And there's like 100 other words like that. Aside from the fact that Robert Kiyosaki, no, that's pronounced wrong. Like every proper name has to be pronounced right. All these, it was really quite an experience.
Well, then you also have to have the thing that really threw me, all of that. And then also that you had to have the same tonality all the time so that it sounded like you read it from start to finish in one breath.
I didn't get that. They kind of let me go off. And it's funny. My mom was a giant Barbara Streisand fan. And after she passed, I got the Barbara Streisand autobiography, which normally, I like Streisand, but I'm not going to read 900 pages of her history. And then somehow Audible said, oh, you bought the book, you're entitled to the audio version for free. So I started listening to it on a flight. And mid-conversation, she interrupts herself and says, I'm going to stop the book here for a second and just tell you a funny story. Hmm. And it's like, Barbara, not for nothing, but you got 900 fucking pages. Really? There's more?
Yeah.
And but I love the idea of her interrupting herself. So I did that a few times, and I'm curious how much of that made it into the final audio version. Mm-hmm. I haven't listened to it, but there must be like a dozen, you know, hey, let me just add this side note. Here's what really happened. And I didn't put it in there, but I'll tell you guys. And so it was kind of fun doing that. Had I not listened to 100 pages of Streisand, I would not have found that.
Barry Ritholtz, co-founding chairman and chief investment officer of Ritholtz Wealth Management, also the author of this great book, How Not to Invest, the ideas, numbers, and behaviors that destroy wealth and how to avoid them. It's going to be a wrap of this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I enjoyed this episode very much. What a great opportunity to spend time with a good friend from way back, Barry, and bring back some memories, talk about the things we talked about. I think there was a wealth of information in this show. Thank you for joining me this week. Looking forward to next week. Frank Curzio is coming on, and we have a lot to talk about with him as well. Be safe, be happy, and invest wisely. And I'll see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.